I think our target audience won't be able to handle more than like 10 minutes of this.
I've got an incredibly short attention span as well. Yeah, so
like, you know, get in, say it, get out. Like, I don't really, I mean, well, also we'll just see how long it is. Like maybe we're so fascinating, it will be like 20 minutes, or maybe it's like, we kind of don't have much to say and it'll be like 7. Like, I don't know.
4 days later, they're still going on.
And then,
oh God! Cool. All right. So, do you want to introduce?
So sure. Yeah. So basically, hello, welcome to this audio experience with you today. We have Dr. Romani Reagan, who has her PhD in cemetery heritage, and over to you.
And I am Sheldon Goodman, and I run a blog called Cemetery Club, and I'm also studying for a master's in public history at the University of Birkbeck, because I want to get all academic on yourselves. So we are two cemetery enthusiasts, passionate ambassadors for them, you could say, and we love to share their heritage, their histories, and the stories that are within them.
We should probably say how this started. So it started kind of from a Facebook post, where it was actually a friend of my mom, and she'd posted about all of the trials and tribulations that happened throughout the 20th century, and basically using an example person who'd been born in 1900 and the things they would have experienced. They would have experienced World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, obviously, of course, the Spanish flu, and the various things that would have happened to somebody over the course of even just a 80 or 90 year lifespan. And when you put all of the things that this mythical person would have gone through and then compare them against the current strife that we're in, it kind of helps you have a little bit of perspective that, yes, one day this will end. One day society will move on, and hopefully with a couple lessons behind it, because after World War II, of course, we were blessed with NHS. So maybe this might be a time to pause and think and make some improvements, as opposed to just bemoaning the fact there's not enough on Netflix.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing I took from this particular post is that it shows you very clearly, obviously, what's happened in the 20th and indeed the 21st century. But it also makes me realise that, hell, do you know what? I think as a generation, I hate to use this term, and I use it in inverted commas very much so, but had it easy to an extent, with that little caveat. Because when I read through it, you know, and you're saying, oh, you know, you're 29, the Great Depression begins, unemployment hits 25%, global GDP drops 27%, and then, you know, then you're 62 and you've got the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think for our generation, Romani, for the past 20 years, we've been living in a fairly secure, inverted commas again, secure bubble. I think we've had a very, and again, you know, that's not to kind of denigrate the likes of the Iraq War or any kind of tensions that we got with Russia and all that kind of stuff. But I think collectively, we've had it pretty calmly, considering how our parents and our own grandparents probably must have done. If you look at things like my grandmother, for example, she was one of 8 children. 6 of her siblings died. No one in my family died until I was 14. And by that point, I wasn't really savvy enough with death to work out what the hell was going on. And you compare it with that post and you think, flipping hell, death seems to be far more prevalent and indeed accepted in yesterday times rather than today.
Absolutely. Well, I think what's interesting about what's happening today, that's because I was having some thinks about, you know, how is this moment affecting us, and how is this matching and rhyming and then sort of clashing with the way it's happened in the past? And I think one thing that I've noticed, at least with how we're experiencing this pandemic, is in some ways you could say that death is now once again brought back into our personal lives. But in an interesting sort of way, it also isn't, because a lot of the deaths we have they're from a remove. So a lot of the death that we're speaking of is on TV, much like when we discuss school shootings or rising knife crime or tragedies that are happening in countries and wars that are far away from us. There's this idea that anything that happens on television almost puts into the realm of entertainment. Even if it's shock entertainment, it's a televised experience. It's not an intimate experience. Yeah. And since this pandemic, by its very nature, has made us separate from each other, we don't have any sort of embodied sense of death, which they would have had in previous generations. The idea of, especially in Victorian times, where you would be caring for the dying person in your home, you would wash your body.
That's an incredible point, because now, you know, whenever you get ill, or, you know, if you're kind of nearing end of life care, you're just, you know, you're put into a hospital or a hospice. You know, gone are the days, I find, largely, where you die with your family around you at home in a familiar setting. I mean, of course, that's not the golden rule. That does still happen. You know, you're born, you live, you die. It's the death bit is so kind of cotton walled now, I think. And when you're faced with the incredible death toll that we're seeing at the moment, you know, which almost rivals, I mean, again, I think I mentioned this to you earlier when we were kind of discussing what we should be saying, Romany, when I was talking about how an East London mosque has taken over a couple of railway arches to make a kind of standalone mortuary. And yeah. You've got the Gardens of Peace up in Haynau in Essex and other Muslims. And they're seeing 16 funerals a day. And you're thinking, flipping hell, this is almost like Victorian level. And, you know, you look at the likes of Tower Hamlets, you know, you go through the archives, you think, yep, 16, 17, 18 funerals a day. Nothing to them. It wasn't unusual because, you know, there was no antibiotics. There was no health service that, you know, if you got ill, generally speaking, you probably didn't recover from it. And I think now that we are faced with a new disease that has kind of blindsided us a little bit, but it shouldn't have done, frankly, because again, as part of my dissertation I'm doing for my master's, where pandemic prevention, I mean, one was due. And I'm not saying that that excuses the kind of slightly slipshod approach that our government seems to have taken to it. But this was coming. And when this is over, another one will come. It's just part of the natural process of being human, be it the Spanish flu or the Russian flu. I mean, it's just something that will always be there, because at the end of the day, fundamentally, we are animals, and animals get sick and they get diseases. Diseases don't stay the same. I mean, just on a tangent as well, I was remembering an old Doctor Who episode with David Tennant. A weird one. Bear with me, Romany. Bear with me.
I'm
They were talking about this. It was a hospital in the year 5 billion. I think New Earth. And they talk about humanity, and it's this hospital, and it's full of all these weird and wonderful diseases. Someone's turned red and is floating. Someone's turning into stone. And Rose says to the doctor, like, what's happening here? What's going on? And the doctor, you know, to paraphrase, says, you know, humanity evolves, but then so do the diseases. And this is just the next step in that process. You know, this is something that I don't think is going to be going away. It's going to put considerable pressure on our bereavement services, on funerals, on cemeteries, on crematoriums. And it's about wondering, what the hell do you do? Because this is something that we've never encountered before in our own lifetime, from how it was navigated in the 1918 pandemic, when the authorities did their very best to kind of hide it because they just dealt with the First World War and they didn't have this on their plate as well, trying to manage it. And then also, hopefully, in years to come, when another pandemic comes in the wake of this one, people hopefully looking back on how we dealt with it and going, oh, actually, at least we got a bit of visibility as to what the hell's going on here. Because if you look at 1918, if you look at the ones of the 1890s, where do you begin? It's almost like we're ashamed of it. And it's not saying that we should be proud of it either, but there needs to be an honesty, I think, which shines down the generations, because it's almost like torch bearing. It's like, yeah, do you know what? We kind of went through this. At the end of the day, this is an infection. This is how we dealt with it. Here's some help for you. I don't know.
Well, I think there is something in that when it comes to when we went through the 20th century. It was this idea of marching ever onwards towards progress. And yeah. When you had a double barrel on that. So you had, with medical procedures getting increasingly better, you had antibiotics, and all of a sudden you had more successful surgeries. And so you have people who are dying with less frequency. And then coupled on top of that, then you started having professional funeral homes, and you had embalming. And so you had people not only living longer and dying less often, then you also had the people who did die were then taken away from their loved ones. And so what you end up having is this, it's almost retro to die. Oh, that doesn't happen nowadays, you know? And so what you have is you do have this sequestering away. And so you have not only the dead bodies themselves, but also the dying persons themselves. And you have people dying in care homes. You have people who are not having this embodied interaction with not only their loved ones who were dying, but also on a governmental level, there's this idea that we don't want to go there. This happened in the past. And now the only thing I would say, if we were to talk about what could we get out of this, how will things look different? And you look at perhaps, you know, the NHS development after World War II, these are moments when there is a mirror held up to society. What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? And I do think that one of the benefits here is that, at least especially in the US, it is shining, and it's kind of upping the contrast on everything that is broken and fractured, at least in the U.S., you know, I use healthcare, I use that word loosely, the health system and the lack thereof here. And I think that, but when it comes to, governmental stuff, I think, is out of our purview. What I think might interest our listeners mostly is this idea of a shift to memorial. And you had mentioned the idea that, I was thinking about this before we had our chat, and I was thinking that the evolution of transferring away from burial towards cremation fractured the people memorialize their dead, in the sense that instead of having a set grave that they go to, more often people started scattering their ashes. And there was this amazing study. So this guy, John Wiley, he published a study in 2009 about memorial benches, and this concept of when you come to a grave, you're standing over the grave and you're looking down at that person. It's really locked in space. It's locked in the ground, quite literally. Whereas a memorial bench, you sit on the bench. It's almost like you're sitting with the lost loved one and looking out. So it's a shared view that you share with the memory. And so if you already dislocate, memory from actual burial into a memorial bench, and then now today we have, like, for example, I have a dear friend who just lost his father and he couldn't go to the funeral. And so they had to hold a funeral separate that was far away from all friends and family. And then they're basically having to kick the memorial later into the year when people are allowed to be together again. And so you not only have, you now have a double fracturing. So you don't have the buried body that you would have had with a burial, but now even with a cremation, you're separated again, because that interment is different from the eventual memorial that you end up having down the line, which might even be 6 months later, we're not sure. So what you end up happening then is that you get one step, and then one step again further away from actually any real human remains. And I think something interesting happens psychologically when we remove memorial from human remains. That's when it gets to be a bit tricky. I'm not quite sure what the future would look like regarding that, but having us be so separate from our loved ones at the moment, that the 20th century made us increasingly separate from the dying process. And ironically, even though now in this pandemic we have more deaths, we're even more separate than we've ever been before.
Absolutely. And I find, and it's that trend that we seem to have been marching towards, I think, that culminates in, I mean, just to link it back to a blog I wrote about which touched a lot about what you said. It was from the Good Funeral Guide. And it was basically talking about, again, kind of bringing it to the pandemic, about social distancing at funerals, for example. And again, as you said, you know, we've already removed so many steps where in years gone by would be, you know, almost touching the coffin and, you know, handling the body and being every step of the way with a person, even though they happen to be dead. Whereas now you've got this whole new set of rules being implemented. And people, I think it's making us face up to a fact that we're not quite ready for yet, but because of the current situation as it is, we're having to deal with. And, you know, this thing about social distancing at funerals and how you can only have a limited number of people there. You can't even be with a person sometimes when they pass away. Yeah. You know, when you go there, you can only be there with a certain number of people. You know, you can't even hug each other, that kind of thing. And this particular blog where they, you know, very honestly and to their credit, you know, they said, this isn't working. This whole setup isn't working. You are trying to graft one set of rules onto another. Now, this is temporary, hopefully, that this kind of enforced separation that we've got. But I do wonder, and you know, again, we've seen it both. We both know the effect that the First World War had, for example, on mourning. You know, that the grand ostentation, you know, the showing off almost. You know, oh, you know, my Johnny was 24. He died of scarlet fever. Here's a coach with 15,000 coaches behind it, you know, and a big flipping mausoleum made of granite block. I mean, that just went out the window. I'm intrigued to see how an already, as you said, isolationist kind of, you know, don't need a grave, I've got a Facebook page kind of thing.
Because there's a huge thing about, you know, obviously our beloved John Troyer talks a lot about the future mourning, future death, and the digitizing of death memorial. I still think we need something tangible. I think we, even if it is something that's a bench, that's something that is, I mean, it is that psychological remove, but you need to get tactile with it. You need something you can hold and engage with in some physical embodied way. I don't think digital is going to do it for us. Personally,
I don't think so. But then I do kind of wonder, are we saying that because of our natural affectation towards cemeteries? I don't know.
Also, we might be a unique sample set for that.
Well, yeah.
No, we are the world. We are the demographic of all.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
Everyone is exactly like we are. I mean, all joking aside, there've been a lot of studies about the reason why, well, not the reason, but a reason why throughout the course of the 20th century, why people became more the age of death denial and all that was because we were sequestered further away from our loved ones. And this idea that when you do touch a dead body, even if you aren't the one washing it and doing all the actual nuts and bolts of the death process, even just touching, feeling the coldness and the sort of waxy hardness, feeling the sinking, seeing the sinking in the facial features. Because even when you're sleeping, there's still that sort of that life tension that you keep in your face, that there's a lessening. And when you see that firsthand, there's no doubt in your mind that you're with a dead body. Your loved one is not, there's no one home. And when you see that and you feel it and you're like, this is, it's so real. And there's nothing, I mean, anyone who says death looks like sleep, not the ones I've seen. But it's so important though, because they've also done too, they were doing this, I can't remember what it was, and I can't quote it properly, but there was a study someone did on the psychology of loss. And if you have not, if for some reason you've never been able to actually see the dead body of your loved one, there's a far higher incidence of catching them out of corner of your eyes, thinking you see them at the shops, like this, that's kind of like you do when you're obsessing over a weird ex, like you, that feeling never quite goes away. Whereas if you were with the corpse, it does go away. And I think that is an important part of your deep lizard brain knowing they're gone, you know?
I remember when my aunt died a few years ago, and it was the first time it was the second time I'd seen a body. I mean, I saw my nans who died 10 years ago, but it was the first, but she was the first person I touched. Mm-hmm. And there was almost like a closure. Because I'd never touched a dead person before, and I just stroked her cheek and thought, what on earth? This doesn't feel like I thought it would. They don't look like they're sleeping at all. There is no anyone says, oh, don't they look beautiful? It's like, have you been to Specsavers?
Maybe when they're embalmed, they look. I mean, you know, when they're freshly dead, there's some stressful expressions on their face. The face doesn't relax into a position of beauty. It relaxes into something. Sometimes, well, at least from my grandaunt, something that actually was terrifying. I thought she was screaming, and it really affected me for years until I started, you know, studying death studies, and I learned that actually that's the way that your jaw, sometimes the muscles can freeze in certain ways, and she didn't die screaming, but I thought for years she did, just because I'd watched so much television. I'm like, well, that's not what a dead body looks like, because I didn't know. And I think that part of it too is that we have so much media nowadays that gives us the illusion of knowledge, when really what we have is a really plastic, beautiful Barbie version of what none of us, very, very rarely some of us, have experienced firsthand. And once you do, you really do see the difference. And part of the stark difference as well is, I know back in 2013, it was Public Health England. Mm-hmm. They did a study and they polled people about what they thought that was going to happen to them when they died. And 67% said they thought they were going to die at home. And actually, only less than 7% wanted to die in a hospital, as you can well imagine. Well, over 90%, I mean, it's around 90% of people do die in hospital today. Yeah. And so it's the idea that everyone goes, oh, no, I'll die at home. It's like, well, that's not, the data doesn't bear that out. And one thing that maybe having these discussions and discussing the pandemic and being forced to discuss what happens to our loved ones when they get ill might make people realize the reality of the statistical chances of you in the 21st century dying in your bed surrounded by your loved ones is unfortunately really small. And we need to take a hard look at that data and do something with it and stop denying it.
It's also hellishly impractical, because I know when specifically my nan, when she went, she was lucky. She had, and coming from Asian ancestry, you know, we are very much of a, you know, if a family member gets ill, down all tools, you go and you do what you can. My dad and his several siblings were doing 20, you know, on a 24-hour cycle shifts. So she was always, you know, had someone to, you know, like wipe her mouth, or, you know, dress her, wash her, that kind of stuff. You know, this idea of dying at home it's lovely. It's very, very sweet, but thoroughly impractical. Because if you don't have a lot, let's say you've only got one child, or no children even, who's going to look after you? You have to look at that kind of that viewpoint, because it's a lovely thing. And again, we all want to go in our comfort, you know, we all want to, you know, be snuggled up, be comfy and happy. But, you know, if you think you're seriously ill, home is not the place for you. It really isn't.
my childhood best friend, she lost her father last year, and he actually did, he did hospice at home, in her home, and she's an only child. And she said, actually, it was, parts of it were lovely, and it's parts of it were how she imagined, and parts of it, she obviously had to pay for nursing because she couldn't have, first of all, he's heavy. So there are things like that are just kind of these weird nuts and bolts things, and she needed help. So she was paying for hospice nurses plus the special beds they had to bring in. And so she kind of set up a hospital sort of in her home, and she had nurses coming and going. It wasn't this intimate, she was not really that much time really just alone. It wasn't like a film. And also then she said something kind of weird that didn't really occur to her. She's like, my father died in my living room. She's like, I didn't think that was going to bother me, but it does. Like, I look at that corner where I put my Christmas tree. Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's like where my father died, and now that's where my Christmas tree goes. It's like things like that you don't really think of, but you know.
It's, I mean, you could extrapolate on that and say, you know, this is the sanctity of a personal living space. You know, again, with the effects that this pandemic's put on, you know, the fact that more people are working from home, for example. I, for one, don't like the fact I'm working from home because this is my social space. If I do blogs or research or dissertation stuff, I want to go to a library or uni because this is my, I don't like to muddy the two. In terms of a death, absolutely, I can absolutely understand why that would be a massive issue. And yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I wouldn't want it personally.
Everyone wants something different. So what is one person's horrible idea is another person's comforting idea. But what we really need to do is, no one knows where they fall on the line of acceptable versus horror until they have the conversation. And what I'm hoping might come out of this is that instead of having this be a taboo thing that only people like you and myself talk about at conferences, then maybe everyone will start having these conversations and really have a hard look at how do they want to die and how do they want to deal with their loved ones when they die. Because also, too, the cemetery process, this used to be a whole community. You would have everyone pulling together to create a memorial experience for you. And now you call up and hire professionals. You're left to your own devices. Uh-huh. There's a sense of this communal coming together. Garden cemeteries offered that. We don't have anything that really is an avatar for that today, I don't think.
No, we don't. And I think that's, you could, I would argue, I definitely say, those once, operative garden cemeteries are now largely redundant because they're full. So therefore, the shift, where do you put that shift? And, you know, you could go down the whole, well, you know, let's look at like cemetery reuse and grave reuse, or how do we use these spaces of memory now that they're largely full? Well, that, I mean, you know, flipping out, we could turn this into a series, Romilly, but I think it's just, but in terms of this pandemic, which I think is giving us a very, very, very blunt crash course reminder about the very ephemeral nature of our lives. And how, you know, we are part of an ongoing chain. You know, one day we'll be dead, and so will our children, and so will our children's children. It comes in different ways. It comes in different manifestations. It could be through war. It could be through disease. It could be through any number of things. But I think the thing that I find really fascinating about this whole thing, and again, going off the back of that Facebook post, is just how I think the thing that's different for us is that we are being exposed to it on an almost 24/7 basis. I think in years gone by, that wasn't really the case. Yes, you had family members die around you, yes, for sure. But in terms of being updated about, you know, like, you know, Turkey's death rate or the terrible cases in New York, we've got Twitter, we've got Google News, we've got BBC News. We are literally being bombarded with this over and over and over again. Whereas back in the day, you'd get your newspaper once a morning. Or you get like morning edition and the evening edition. We have so much more visibility on what's going on now in terms of death and dying, which is, you know, that I think that there, as I said, there are positives to that because, you know, again, trying to fight a pandemic in 2020, I think, is a far more connected affair than it was when it was, say, 1918, when you had, you know, even with the naming of the thing, the Spanish flu, simply because the Spanish press were at liberty to report about it. I mean, the fact that you're allying a nationality to it, I mean, you know, that's why people are now pleased, at least with this, you know, it's not known as the Wuhan flu or the Chinese flu. It's COVID-19. That's absolutely right. We shouldn't put...
Syphilis, wasn't it called the French pox?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, we always want to blame someone else, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Again, you know, that's ongoing. And I'm glad that in this particular instance, you know, again, in 100 years' time, I don't know who's... what virus, I mean, COVID 1985 or whatever the hell, I don't know. But I think it's again, you know, there was me thinking that this, for my dissertation topic, was going to be, well, it's not going to be a walk in the park, but it's going to be interesting. It has now exploded because this has literally shaken not only the way that we live, but the way that we die as well, and in memory and so on. These funerals are now happening with a limited number in attendance. You know, does that almost cheapen their memory? I've had very frank discussions with my own parents, you know, saying, you know, if you know, if you only had like 10 people there, but you wanted 50, do you feel that that bookend to your life is not how you wanted it? Again, you have no control over it, but would you feel like that? Because for me, you know, being honest, and again, you know, my own perception of death, if I was to pop my clogs because of COVID or your heart attack or whatever, and I could only have 10 people at my funeral, number one, I wouldn't, well, there's nothing I could do, I'd be dead. But how would I feel that that would affect my memory and my way of being remembered? Yeah, I probably would. I wouldn't be happy about it. The ritual and the way the end of life is celebrated, as it rightly should be, is really being kind of pushed to the brink at the moment. And I think in years to come, where they look at how we can even interact with the dead the way we usually could, I think it's going to be so fascinating. And I hope it'll be recorded far better than it was in 1918. Because looking for, again, when I went to, I found on Ancestry, I was doing a bit of research around Beckenham Cemetery, and I found this picture of an incredibly handsome young man. I will be honest with you, Roman, he was very handsome. And I just thought, okay, well, he's clearly here. Let's see what I can find out about him. He was a victim of a pandemic. He died in Crystal Palace at in the like naval training reserve that they had there. And he was buried far from home. He came from Lancashire. He was buried in Beckenham. And it was just, when you look in a cemetery, you think he wasn't the only one. This was a pandemic of probably bigger proportions than what we're seeing now for the moment. Where are their stories? Where are they? And it kind of, not that you'd want to say on a headstone or anything, but this person died of Spanish flu. Occasionally it happens, for sure. And you know, I dare say you've probably seen it around Abney occasionally. If you're part of an event that basically affects the nation and on your own micro history, how will that be disseminated for future historians?
There are a couple things. I think that from, once again, absolutely not a historian on the Spanish flu at all. I did actually go see it last year. Little did I know how prescient it was going to be. Catherine Arnold's talk on her new book that she released last year was Pandemic in 1918. And it's so funny because we were all sitting there thinking, you know, sitting in our high horses thinking, oh, the past, it was so fucked, right? Well, here we are. But I think one thing that's interesting about when you discuss about being part of a cultural moment like that, when you think about what it's like to lose your loved one to a cultural moment like that, part of what distances death, and I know this is a kind of rambling because it's kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about the idea that things happening on television and the idea of this right now is a statistic. Yeah. And when you lose somebody that you love, you do not want to have that person be a statistic. You want them to have an identity. And so I think you'd want to almost take that away. You want to strip it out from, no, this wasn't the Spanish flu. This wasn't COVID. This was Tom Schwarzkopf, and I loved him dearly, you know?
That is an absolutely excellent point, yeah, for sure. And also, I think in terms of the memory of the poor people who passed away from it, you know, we owe it to them to think of them like that. You know, the fact that the death toll is far higher than it normally is, and these people dying, otherwise they would be alive if it wasn't for this wretched disease. I mean, look at the discussion that it sparked between us. I'm just hoping that's being replicated, and I think hoping that it's encouraging more and more people to be, this should be a very frank, open discussion that we're all having. I've certainly had it with my parents, you know, when the news first broke, we were saying, okay, mum, dad, if you get it, what's going to happen? If I get it, what's going to happen? Are these discussions being had? Well, yes, they are, but not on anywhere near enough of a scale, I think, where we can face this with a far more knowledgeable, I think.
Yeah, I'm in California right now, so I'm sort of, our cultural moment, I think, is a little bit different than what's happening in the UK, mostly in the sense that, as everyone knows, it's the big elephant in the room. We are in a basically what I would call a cold civil war, and we are not in a space of communication. And so we have two camps. We have the science denying, freedom flag waving people who deny there is even such a thing as a virus. And if there is a virus, it's just like the flu. And they want to go back to work, and they want to make sure that society chugs along in whatever dream world they think we can operate within. And then you have the rest of us who understand that this is something we all need to do together. And unfortunately, the two camps, I mean, we watch different news networks. We have our different fish bubbles that we live in on our social media accounts. And unfortunately, we have two very different ways of approaching the pandemic, coexisting not very easily side by side within the same cultural conversation. And what that has a knock-on effect doing is that we're not having these conversations with each other. We're having them at each other within our own lane, but not between each other, and we're not talking across the aisle. Of course, all of this is going down during an election year, which adds a lot of tension as well. So I think, unfortunately, at least from my perspective in the States, has been the politics of the pandemic have completely overridden any conversation about the personal effects of what's happening between families and friends and being separated. And also, it's not just people being separated, people are also thrust together. And while that happens, who you end up being stuck with. And these personal conversations, which are so key and important, especially to how we try to think about memorial, not only today, but as we go in the next 6 months, next 6 years, how are we going to have changing memorial, these uptick in deaths, where do we put them? How do we honor them? That's all being swept away by this wider political discussion, which has a very impersonal element to it. And it makes me feel that everything has become partisan and nothing has been personal. And that's been bothering me about the conversation we're having.
Oh, God. I mean, I mean, you could. I mean, that's something I've seen. Not to quite the extent over here, but I've certainly seen that myself over here. And it's infuriating when you see it, because you think this is actually something pretty basic, frankly. And the fact that we're not actually, the fact that we've not obviously picked up on it annoys me, for one. And why aren't people not picking up on it enough quickly? Because it's important. It's massively important. Why are we just being so blinkered to it? It's fascinating to see, but also enraging at the same time.
I don't think we have experience. I think that's what's so, I mean, it's one thing I always think of is that we always look in the past and say that was a golden age. No one living in a golden age ever knew they were. They thought it was just, oh, wow, now is better than then. Yeah. And so I feel like we're going to look back, let's say, I don't know, 20 years from now, I think we're going to look back at this sort of 20th century bubble, and we're going to think of it as a golden age of death denial. And we need to come out the other end of it with some tools in our toolbox to deal with the sort of labor of grief and the work of processing our own mortality. And I think we've been sort of blithely skipping through the clover, ignoring all the landmines, going, death, not me. And I think now it's come home to stare us in the face, and none of us have the tools to prepare for it. And that, I think, is what we're getting this clash of all of this happening at once, all of it mostly happening on television. We're separated from people, and we don't have the ability to take what's happening in our daily lives and put it in any sort of constructive way. Mm. There's a lot of lashing out. My God, the vitriol on social media has become, I can't even look at Twitter. People are getting mean out there. And we're not functioning well. We're almost like a teenager who suddenly had to grow up real fast overnight. And I don't feel like we have the toolkit to approach this moment with any sort of balanced maturity when it comes to dealing with death that's real.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to say, what would you say would be the way through that? How would you say would be best? But I mean, again, I think it'd be best if there was a kind of a universal approach. As you say, I think it's very fragmented at the moment. Different countries are responding in different ways as to how, not only in terms of restrictions, but also in terms of commemoration, in terms of memorial, in terms of death. What would you say would probably be the best way forward in terms of trying to break that cycle and break that down and make things frankly better?
I think the one thing that we need to understand too is that I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you've come up with this in your research, is this notion of, unquotes, the way things always have been. And we go, well, we do this because it's the way it's always been done. And whenever you look up the definition of the way it's always been done, it's always been done for maybe 50 years or something. And one thing that we have I would argue throughout, at least I would say throughout Europe and through the Americas, is this idea of in perpetuity. Now, the idea of having a memorial in perpetuity was a Victorian idea. Previous to that, you did not. You would have your parish churchyard, and you would rotate, and the graves would, your bones would be chucked in the charnel house and make space for the next one. And that's how you were able to use a churchyard over centuries, was the fact that this space is being reused. And I think that as much, I mean, you, of course, once again, we love cemeteries. We know this. I love a coffin. I love a bear. I love bones moldering in the earth. I love stone memorial. I love all of this with a deep passion. However, I also understand that this was a moment in time when that was something that was done, this idea of in perpetuity. I think if we're going to be looking at an uptick in deaths, we have way more people on the planet than we ever thought possible. I think the way forward would be to get rid of this idea of something has to be in perpetuity. All it really needs to do is be in living memory of your descendants, which at least according to the HTA is 100 years, the Human Tissue Act. Anything over 100 years is considered fit for public display because it's past living human memory. And that's how I feel we should look at our memorials. Anything past living human memory is just sort of a burden to future generations. And I think that when we look at how we want to communicate this to people we're with today, I think instead of focusing on a stone or a specific piece of land that's going to be the embodiment of your love for this person, fine, kick the memorial 6 months down the road, maybe a year down the road. Have it when you can be with people, because it's not the object. It's not the stone. It's not the urn. That's not the thing. The thing is actually that ephemeral thing, the idea of living human memory. So take the people who are living, get them together, even if it's completely divorced from the actual interment process, and have a memorial, have a wake, have a piss up in a pub, have a solemn meditation, whatever makes you feel complete with the process of grieving. But do it with loved ones and make sure you can do it when you can be together. And even if it means being delayed. For example, I was supposed to get married this year. Now, I could either have a little quickie wedding and have no one be able to be involved and none of my friends in New York could come because they'd be quarantined, or I could have it a year later and do it when I can actually share it with my loved ones. Does it make my marriage any less important because I'm actually doing it a year and a half after I'm getting married? No, the celebration isn't about the thing. It's about what you make it with others. And that's the, I think, the important thing here is connecting between each other and not being stuck into one locked idea about a time and a place and a stone and what that means.
I think so. I mean, it's going off that, I think also, and again, when my other half lived in Amsterdam, and I would frequently find myself in cemeteries there because he had a day job and I kind of had taken a few days leave and I was wandering around going, where can I go? Cemetery, obviously. And that was what I did. And I loved how the cemeteries there, all the plots are on leased spaces, because I think you have to, especially at a time like this, you have to fundamentally ask, what is a cemetery for? What is it for? It is a place of memory. Yes, granted. But also, you think about, you know, you can look at the romantic graves of Kensal Green or West Norwood or whatever. And you think, right, well, it's lovely and we love it. We both love them. But those are intimate private spaces, an echo of a past grief. The mourners who go there now are now themselves dead.
Yep.
What do you do with, you know, let's say, you know, just for, in terms of, you know, let's say Dr. James Barry and Kensal Green. Henry Bessemer in West Norwood, or Charlotte Mew in Hampstead, or what have you. What do you do with a grave that has no mourners? As you say, you know, it's the immediacy of wanting to do things right now. As you said, your wedding's not happening immediately. Does it need to happen now? Well, no, because you can just wait until the situation calms down. Likewise, I think that that's a really good idea in terms of memorials and remembering people and those poor souls who've lost their lives, this flipping awful thing. God, do you know, I think I've just been bowled over by the magnitude of this, Romney. I've actually felt my brain explode. Oh my God. Because again, when I was speaking to you about this before, and I think, and you know, this is really important stuff. And, you know, we are but two people in a global situation at the moment. Again, the importance of a stone or of a grave or a plot. I mean, I think, you know, that's going to be lessened as the years roll on, especially as a result after this. But, oh, God, I don't know what I'm saying anymore, Romney. Honestly, I'm so overwhelmed.
Well, I think it's because we're straddling so many different moments simultaneously, because there's a lot of stuff that you and I have been banging on for years about that all of a sudden is sort of coming to a head in this moment, but also stuff that we've been writing about for years. So how do you encapsulate every single aspect of this into one conversation and just... It's sort of like it shatters into this kaleidoscopic pantheon of what?
Yeah. Here's a question for you, Romney. Mm. Are cemeteries a good use of space?
Yes.
Discuss.
Okay, so here's the thing. Now, my space of research were particularly Victorian garden cemeteries, which are a unique thing in the sense that, as you and I know, but maybe some people don't know, is a cemetery is not involved with a church. A graveyard and a churchyard are connected to a church. A cemetery is an independent secular space. They can have religion imposed upon them, but they are not inherently religious. And especially with my site of research, Abney Park Cemetery, it is an unconsecrated, non-denominational cemetery founded by a secular company, the cemetery company. So this idea of the Victorian Garden Cemetery, it wore quite a few hats, of which being a cemetery was only one. The idea that it was going to be a oasis in an urban center as the increasing urban sprawl. You have
few gardens.
Yes, exactly. And especially in Abney Park Cemetery, there was 1,029 varieties of rose. And they had so, I didn't even know there were this many varieties of rose, quite frankly, let alone all in one place. Their rosarium, it was a collection that rivaled Kew. And people could go there, and it was a 32-acre space, an oasis right in the middle of Stoke Newington. And of course, just like the other Magnificent Seven, these were dotted in a ring around what used to be Outer London. And so they used to be places that were a arboretum where you could enjoy exotic specimens you wouldn't get a chance to see. There were free entry, as you can imagine. You could bring your family for a day out. And also, it was one of the few places that women could go unchaperoned. So there could be matrimonial possibilities. So there was very much, at least when the Victorian Garden Cemeteries were founded, these were community spaces. And the people were invited and welcomed to have their family go for walks. So in that sense, when you think about strictly a Victorian Garden Cemetery, which is, once again, my area of research, I can't speak to other kinds of cemetery, their purpose is still being served today. So I think the problem that we have is if we have a cemetery that is locked into one purpose, and the way a lot of cemeteries are surviving today is to diversify what that purpose is. If you would look at them as being community spaces, of which being a cemetery was only one aspect of serving the community, then yes, they're still serving their community admirably today. But if you look at something that is strictly a cemetery where there are no dogs, no picnics, no movies, no music, no life, no anything, then yes, those cemeteries, that's an outmoded model because who is going to fund it? Events fund these places. And with no more burial, you end up with no more revenue coming in. So in that sense, if you would have a brand spanking new cemetery with nothing but burial at all, it, once it fills up, you would have to diversify yourself even then. So I think it depends on what memorial is, what you want it to be. I'm really in love with natural burial because there's no chemicals, no processing, incredibly cheap to do. You literally just chuck someone in a shroud, put them in the ground, job done. And you have, this is because there's no embalming and there's no barrier between yourself and the earth. You are able to actually be able to decompose back into the earth. And it's only natural burial that allows you to do that. Other kinds of processing, they put a burial between you. So then you do fill up. But if your body is decomposing underneath there, then there's no such thing as filling up. You're not taking up space. And once the memory of you being gone, and also especially I know a friend of mine was buried in a natural wooden burial ground where they didn't even allow stone markers. You could have a wooden marker. So once again, even the idea of the marker would be there and it's a carved, beautiful thing for you, for your loved ones to experience. But even that itself would then be eroding back into the earth. And I love that idea about the body and the stone and the memory and the people all eroding and making space for something new.
I think that's one thing that the Victorian cemetery companies probably, well, again, they probably, it wasn't at the forefront of their mind. They probably thought money was the first thing.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I like that. I mean, I think I love the idea where, I love the idea that the graves are, say, on a 10, 20, 30-year leasehold. Because, I mean, when I went to a cemetery in Amsterdam, it was as old as Kensal Green. Did it seem it? No, because all the plots were reused. And it was very much more a communal open. So there were people tending to the, what were they growing? They're growing vegetables on their loved ones' graves. I mean, not that I would do that. I mean, you know, there's a whole other thing there as well. I mean, you know, death veg, brilliant. But as you say, you have all these other things that a cemetery can be. Certainly, as a cultural and a social space. Yeah, absolutely. That is so important. And yeah, that's a definite thing that it should be. But also as an ongoing space. Primarily, they are places of remembrance and memory. And I love that idea of, you know, of those wooden markers. And they're almost like eroding, just like the memory of the person beneath them is. And I know Arnas Vale's got a natural burial woodland as part of its grounds as well. Which is, and it's such a juxtaposition because you've got all those big Victorian pink granite obelisks. You've got all those like old headstones, which are chock-a-block full of children who probably passed away over a particular virulent bout of whooping cough one weekend. And then literally on the next section, you've got this lovely woodland glade and you're walking over people, literally. You never know they're there. Yeah. And I think, frankly, I prefer that because it's more, being in balance with nature. It's more, I think it's kinder, frankly. And I think also in terms of longevity, yeah, it's less of a headache for people down the years, because when you've got a full cemetery, as you say, and it depends on who's overseeing them. You know, as you know, some are more on it than others in terms of, okay, how can we benefit the local community now? Yes. Rather than basically shutting the gates and thinking, oh, well, full. That just invites antisocial behaviour. It's a logistical nightmare to manage and maintain, especially, let's say, in a council-run cemetery where money is already at a push. From the very off, a cemetery that is like, okay, we are dynamic, we do lots of events, we do, like, you know, death cafes. Every cemetery should have a death cafe, for example, I think. Some sort of social element for the living as well as the dead. A people museum, that kind of thing. Every cemetery, I think, should have like a columbarium, but with interactive displays or something about the people who are there, if you want. That yeah. kind of thing. Because otherwise, what would you do with a cemetery that's not fulfilling its potential? You know, you could argue who's giving these rules that it's not fulfilling its potential. But in terms of like my original question, are cemeteries a good use of space? I think they are, but I think in some cases they could certainly be managed an awful lot better, because when you have events like pandemic, COVID-19, and you think, ooh, okay, right, how, wow, what do you, well, yeah, oh God, brain blast again, Romney. Oh my God, where's the sherry? Where's the sherry? I've run out.
No. I think honestly, what, you know, once again, if we're to loop back to the idea of whenever we've had a major cultural disruption, it forces us to sort of put down our coffee and look up and really take stock. And one of the things that it is illustrated in quite a few countries is countries who behaved and responded timely and well, and countries that have not. And it's not just about controlling the pandemic. I think we're going to see now in the coming year, and probably maybe even the next coming 5 years. Once again, countries who've responded well and countries who have not. And yeah. we're probably going to be looking at these systems. One benefit we have now today is the rapid fire, immediate exchange of information is we're able to learn from each other more quickly as well. And I think that highlighting who's handling this well, who isn't handling this well, I have, anyone taking bets about who won't handle it well? I think that handling how we handle our ill is unfortunately, I think, going to be mirrored in how we handle our dead. And the same countries are going to fall down on both counts, I think. And I think that what we need to do is actually just asking the question, I think, is a huge step in the right direction. Because right now, I don't think we've been asking these questions enough. And the pandemic is forcing all of us to really sit down and have conversations that used to be left to just to the likes of us.
Yes. Yeah. And I think this, as you know, as we've said throughout this entire recording, I think these questions should definitely be asked. And there's no shame in asking them as well, I think. This is a pandemic. This is something that we've never had to experience. Being prepared, there is no punishment for being prepared. Absolutely not. And I think as long as people are more honest about it and more open, and, you know, there's no taboo, really, because it's you know, we can't all die in our 80s, to be perfectly blunt about it. As you know, going right back to the start of the recording, where you said, you know, death itself is now shuttered off from so many aspects of our lives now. When we are eventually confronted with it, we just don't know what the hell to do. We can't process it, really. One of the good things, again, it's a shame it's taken this to make people open up about it. But on the other side of the coin, it's good that it's happened in that regard. It's just exchanging this open dialogue between people. Again, you know, I frequently converse with people on my Twitter, and I'm sure you do too, about people who are going, oh, well, you know, all this has really made me question my own existence and my own validity and my own, you know, what's my legacy going to be? And, you know, and I'm not sure if that's really on. Of course it's on. Absolutely. This is the whole point of it. You know, this is something that you should always bear in mind whenever you go through your life. You know, the fact that you have a limited time and, you know, hopefully you won't succumb to, you know, COVID-19. Hopefully you have many, many years of happiness and, you know, what else in front of you. But these are questions you should ask regardless, no matter your health. You know, you could be a fit 18-year-old who plays football every Sunday, or a 64-year-old man who's got type 2 diabetes, he's lost a limb, he can't get out of jail. It doesn't matter. You should always have that at the very nub of your soul, I think, because I think being honest with yourself about it is not only kinder on you, it's kinder on your family. It's also, frankly, less of a stress on the wider community, because everyone just knows. So I think, again, as a study, I think in years to come, and people are looking, and hopefully with the advent of like Twitter and Instagram and what have you, and knowing how poorly documented so many aspects of 1918 were, when you look at the COVID 2020, oh God, I hope that's not a slogan they use for it in years to come. Oh God, can you imagine COVID 2020? They'll look.
People are already making a joke about 2020 vision and all this kind of thing.
Oh God, no!
Like we now see the world in 2020. Get it?
Oh God, but there's no, it's all on fire, Romney. Can't see anything. But I think we should probably leave it there, Romney, because that was a beast. There's so much to take away from that. I don't know where this is going to be published, but I think if anyone listens, let us know what you think, because again, we want to be part of a discussion that really, you know, propagates this and pushes it out into the open and the mainstream. And again, mainstream. But these are discussions that we should be talking about. We should be scared of having either, more importantly, I think, as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they're opening. And that's sort of the thing, too, is that you and I can, you know, talk for ages. And something I've always noticed about in conferences and whatever, I give my little bit, and then it's the Q&A that's always the interesting part. And yeah. I feel like you and I are having our own panel discussion, completely unmoderated and unchecked. we desperately need someone to raise their hand and say, excuse me.
There's an audience in the room. Hello. 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 Hello, there are people here as well. Hello, can we partake?
I think we're thirsty for someone else's questions and conversation, because I think that left to our own devices, we can just go off on one. So, yes, if anyone has any thoughts, questions, you know, preferably nothing too horrendous to say, but you know, you never know. We're open to that too.
Well, yes. Yeah, so if you've got any questions, do send them in. Otherwise, we will. I don't know. Look, we should probably do another one, I think, because that seems to be a rousing success. Right. So anyway, enjoy, all listeners. And cool.